Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 127, where Rowan, Sarah, and Tom are discussing an article from Mark Granovetter titled Economic Action and Social Structure, The Problem of Embeddedness, published in the American Journal of Sociology in 1985. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
In part one of this episode, we set up the battle that Granovetter sets up between kind of two camps of social thought. Then we talked about his suggestion of a third approach, which is this embeddedness approach. And we also covered the two main ways in which he argues for this. One is when he explores the question of trust versus malfeasance and why is daily life not rife with malfeasance and fraud. And in the second part, he tries to similarly, you know, sticking to the theme of this third way, threading between under and over socialized accounts, he tries to use his embeddedness approach as a way to critique Oliver Williamson's program of markets and hierarchies, which a lot of us know as transaction cost economics from perhaps our doctoral programs. Now, he essentially does this in two ways, where he starts off saying that Williamson argues for, you know, markets for the kinds of things that can be, that are impersonal, that are not transaction specific, that are standardized repeated exchanges, and that can be kind of contracted for or accounted for in contractual relations. And meanwhile, Williamson says hierarchies exist when you do have transaction specific investments, you do have a lot more uncertainty about outcomes, bounded rationality, risk for opportunism. Of course, this is just rehashing the arguments of transaction cost economics. But the idea is that if I bring this into the language of under-socialized, over-socialized, the Williamson's research program suggested that in markets, relationships can be under-socialized because you can just govern it based on contracts. And in hierarchies, they need to be over-socialized because you're governing based on authority structures. Similar, again, to the Hobbesian concept of a Leviathan. What Williamson does is he simply starts to argue that on the one hand, there are relationships in the market setting that are not as under-socialized as you would think. And so that's where he talks about, we discussed this in part one, for example, people belonging to the same country club, a buyer and a supplier. And so these contractual disputes are handled separately in a smoke-filled room, to continue the metaphor from part one. And on the other hand, in a hierarchy, in an organization, it's not as over-socialized as you think. People do act, there's deviant behavior within organizations. People do act out of self-interest as well. Or you might have, and he draws on research by Dalton, who was an ethnographer, who shows how in different plants within organization have different kind of subcultures, or they might choose to hide things from headquarters when it's audit time. So again, so markets are not as under-socialized as Williamson might say, and hierarchies are not as over-socialized as Williamson might say. And so coming back to this theme of the whole paper, an embeddedness approach helps you to thread the needle or kind of go in between those two approaches.
Yeah, and thank you for that recap, because it now gets into what I was sort of bringing up towards the end of part one. And that's a social dimension of a different sort, I suppose. You know, there was, when morality was mentioned in the article, it was mentioned sort of in the context of a sense of principle, of dutiful or honest behavior. It was, was presented as this altruistic ideal attitude, okay? What I was alluding to, I guess, was more of an ethical challenge, in which for any given situation or a given decision that's made, the extent to which it follows one of these or abides by one of these three conditions or viewpoints, perspectives, I guess. Those who abide by the other two perspectives probably view that decision as being flawed in some way. And I think that becomes that wonderful sense of tension. It's not just a clash of the systems, but it's a clash of what's considered to be an appropriate view of the world. Whereas if you're doing things in the back room, in the smoke-filled room, then those who are exercising the economic man model and who are looking at this will look at those types of decisions as inherently wrong or unfair, and therefore try to impose more of that perspective into the mix, demanding objective accountability or objective measures of justifying the need for the decision outside of, you know, outside of the legal process. And same with the other way around. If you're if you are building a system that is intensely legal and you come from the perspective of one who knows that the only way to really make hard decisions is to go into the smoke-filled room and hash it out, mano a mano, then you're going to look at this other perspective as a cold, unfeeling, horrible bureaucracy. It's going to be bureaucracy in the worst possible way, not the way that some members of our cast like to think favorably of bureaucracy. This is the wrong kind of bureaucracy, even when the bureaucracy is functioning correctly. So I had the difficulty for myself, because I think in terms of ethics, of separating the ethics from the discussion. So yeah, you've got the three perspectives, but how one perspective responds to the other two, I think is a potential source of conflict that might be unnecessary. I don't know. Yeah, I'll stop there.
The only thing I would say to that is I don't know if the article takes a position, or if it takes a position, it doesn't privilege the moral, just, ethical, pick your favorite, solution, right? It's taking issue with the economist efficiency argument, right? What is the most rational and efficient and robotic solution to each of these situations, right? And he tries to bring up the fact that if you don't follow the robotic path, you then must follow the human ethical generalized morality that he talks about, right? But I'm pretty confident in thinking, when you go through the article, that it doesn't prioritize one over the other. It doesn't say one is better. It doesn't say one should. In fact, it brings up issues of normativity. So there is a footnote, you know, I always read the footnotes, that talks about parallels here with Burtian models, which Rowan's been bringing up, but I don't think we actually explicitly said, hey, this is a year after Burt's, major social theories. And he says that there are many parallels between what are referred to as the under-socialized and over-socialized views of action and what Burt, in 1982, chapter 9, calls the atomistic and normative approaches. So I think if we remind ourselves that there is the other approach in this A-B battle or A-B test is normativism, and the should, right? Normativism is the what should we do. But I don't think it's explicit in the rest of this article that we're getting to something that we should do. And I think this article and the other Granovetter we read together are really about just saying, hey, everybody, this is the way it is. These are the limits to formal modeling. These are the limits to all of your assumptions and your philosophy and your thought exercises. This is how humans behave, and dragging the econ side into the sociology side, but stopping at setting a normative or prescriptive limit. At least that's how I read the article. Rowan, I don't know, did you read it the same way?
Yeah, 100%. He's essentially kind of being positivistic here and just saying that we get more explanatory power if you just try to explain behavior in terms of that atomistic view, or just in terms of this, you know, generalized morality over socialized view. Both are incomplete, and all the examples he brings in are to show how those wouldn't be covered by either of those two perspectives, and so you need this third perspective to explain without saying which is good or which should win out necessarily. And even the BERT parallel, kind of the atomistic and normative, the normative there refers to norm following, so culture taking approach to explanation, versus the atomistic again refers to the same, the kind of utility maximizing approach. I also did notice that footnote, and I enjoyed the amount of effort, or perhaps not, he spent in distinguishing from the BERT arguments. I haven't read the BERT book, but in this footnote, Granovetter says, you know, my views have an obvious family resemblance to BERT's approach. And then he just basically says, if you want to know the distinction, go read chapter 9 of the BERT book and make your own kind of comparisons, which was, yeah, nicely done. The other thing, though, beyond, I'm glad you brought up this footnote, is that you can see how this is a moment in kind of, if one were doing an intellectual history of sociology, where there's a reason that you have these two big scholars kind of saying similar things in spirit, because it's that idea of looking at someone's patterns of social relations that is common to both these scholars, common to the methodology as well, of course, and that the theorizing kind of behind all of this is that stance of trying to look at immediate patterns of social relationships rather than some macro concept of culture or some micro concept of rational actor models.
Yeah, perhaps what I'm guilty of is trying too hard to think about what do these camps represent in terms of behavior. Because granted, the article does well to establish the weakness of having the two extremes at the start and showing what the third perspective is. And I guess what I'm sort of doing is I'm adding this additional layer of the three strike me as perspectives that people tend to enact, and that like it's not just a matter of a theory that the economic model is a way of explaining the world. It also, to me, represents in practice a thought process of what is considered to be the ought behaviors, to which it's being used as a source of conflict against the other two. And I can go to each of those three parts of the triangle and say kind of the same thing, which is, to me, actually a great power of the article, that it brings up this third triangle that explains so much more that the other two didn't on their own. When we go through some of the examples that were in the article and then we apply them more to contemporary, these three do kind of represent different worldviews, I think, of the connections between economic action and social structure that I think are playing out, because you have those who really do look at the world in a very strict economic lens that use certain ways of measuring the legitimacy of a decision. And the same with the embedded view, and the same with the third view. You know, it's not that there's a prescription, but it's kind of like a recognizable and almost easy to anticipate source of conflict when it comes to understanding the context behind which decisions are made. Like, when and why do people choose to approach the same kind of a decision through different ways? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense to me. And I do think if you were a policymaker, then you would have to think quite critically about which perspective to try to move or to try to shift people along. You know, we use that example of smoke-filled rooms, which has, you know, mostly negatives, potentially counterintuitive positives. But again, as a policymaker, we use the example of quitting smoking. You know, how much do you try to influence patterns of relationships? How much do you try to influence culture? How much do you try to influence, nudge individual human behavior, which a lot of behavioral policy teams nowadays do? And to your broader point about the kind of normative side of this, even if we focus on this third way, this embeddedness approach, I think that comes out a little bit in another big sociology paper that comes out 3 years later, I think in AJS, which is James Coleman and Social Capital. And so now Social Capital is a positive version of this, these patterns of social relationships. So social capital exists in this third space that Granovetter is describing, so is laying out descriptively. But the point of the Coleman paper is more of how this can be a resource. So, you know, he uses the example of, you know, kids playing in the playground. Now, you might not trust at the level of society or the country or the community. You might not have the resources yourself to monitor, but you trust your neighborhood or your block or your cul-de-sac or wherever you live. And so then that pattern of social relations, to use Granovetter's term, becomes a resource in Coleman's formulation of the concept of social capital.
There is, you're right that social capital, the major AJS paper, comes out 5 years after this one. But going back to that footnote that we enjoy, he does reference Coleman's work already and says, another approach that resembles mine in its emphasis on how social connections affect purposive action is Marsden's extension of James Coleman's theories of collective action, Marsden in 81 and 83, and decision to situations where such connections modify results that would occur in a purely atomistic situation. I think if I can figure a little bit backwards, this is about the families and schools work, as well as the very big power and the structure of society, right? So that's talking about the social, very small, the first unit, which is the family, right? I mean, the household is actually even a smaller unit than a family if you're looking at units, and then following power. So again, it's talking about, as you say, almost the breadcrumbs of the birth of the canon of social theory and following them through. And Norms as Social Capital is right on the heels of this one. And then the whole book, the whole AJS paper, Social Capital and the Creation of Human Capital, next, which then roll into Foundations of Social Theory, claim title, make book, as well as what we're talking about with little letters, Foundational Social Theory.
Yeah, and that goes to show you how there is this broader moment in sociology at the time. If in the 80s you've got, you know, Ron Burt, James Coleman, Mark Granovetter, Marsden, all kind of shifting towards this idea of this, you can think of it almost like a meso level of these patterns of social relations. And one could perhaps even link it to the move away from grand theories in the first half of the 20th century, where whether you're theorizing at the level of that Hobbesian Leviathan, this is how people respond to culture, or at the level of rational actor models, both are much more grand, where it's universally applicable, at least let's say within a country, versus when you come to this patterns of social relations, you no longer have that as much universality, and things become more contingent or more situation by situation.
Well, let me ask a question, because this gets to what I was essentially offering, was sort of like in practice, a grand view, sort of like the attribution of the vulnerabilities or the failings of a particular perspective from one's own perspective. Are we perhaps seeing that, you know, some of the ideological divides, I don't know how else to describe it, is sort of rooted in the treatment of these three perspectives as being universal? And therefore, like, if I'm an economic person, I'm looking at these others as being universally bad, as opposed to just simply other alternatives suitable for the situation.
If you're asking us both individually, I have to go back to the answer that I started this part of the episode with, which is, I don't think there is a universal. I don't think there is a good people do this, bad people do this. I don't think there is a, in this situation, everyone should answer X. It's kind of like when we go back to why are we talking about reputation from part one, which is that you are weighing up the cost to your reputation of acting in a way during this transaction opportunity, as well as what does the solving that opportunity bring you, right? And this is akin to the other episode that we did on using networks to get jobs and sharing information on the housing estate as well. This comes back to what we've discussed in two previous episodes about using our networks for social information, for opportunities, for job advancement, and for why do we maintain these relationships, right? Some of them are for social support. They are for child rearing. They are for division of labor. Sometimes, in this case, they are a general social ledger for transaction opportunities. And we've talked about generalized exchange and direct social exchange before in these. And I think they are about satisfying the needs of those interactions. I don't think there is a universal, I always act like X, or when presented with this situation, I act like Y. And Rowan mentioned read out to us the bit about the best information that you can get and the ladder of information that way. I think you have to think about the ladder for the options, your action options, in the same way, right? There's a set of options of sort of declining optimality that you have to get to, and then you decide which rung to stop on.
Yeah, my thoughts are quite close to that, or to quote Granovetter, they bear an obvious family resemblance to that. And I do think if you take his third way, so let's assume that each of these is not simply a mode of analysis or a choice in descriptive sociology, but rather almost a philosophy, a way of thinking, a way of looking at the world, a perspective. Even then, this kind of embeddedness, or the idea of this paper, is to actually incorporate all, so not to necessarily choose one or the other. And he quotes an entertaining little quip from James Dusenberry on page 485, where he says, economics is all about how people make choices. Sociology is all about how they don't have any choices to make. The idea of this paper is to say that it's a bit of both. People do make choices. Their choices are at the same time influenced by social structure. And a lot of it is happening in this middle ground of your patterns of immediate social relations. And so it's not, you're not like eschewing the other worldviews or discarding it. You're integrating across this idea of economics is all about people making choices and sociology about people not having any choices to make.
Yeah, I flagged that too, the sort of constraint, right? That social network, this birth of social networks as, well, maybe we're showing you the reach of your opportunities, but actually this is saying, maybe we're showing you the level of constraint that is the price of those opportunities. I flagged that quotation too. I loved it.
Okay. And I think I'm starting to really understand this a lot better now, because perhaps what I was guilty of was thinking about the economic as if they were acting according to their perspective. What we're really saying is that they're going to be exercising embeddedness in the way in which they make their decisions. It's not like a worldview so much as a worldview with they're different. And I guess that may be one of the dangers of perhaps painting them as if it's a triangle, because it could make it sound like there are three worldviews in conflict, where one is a little bit in between the two, but it's actually a different layer. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, I do think the layering makes sense. But it's understandable that we do think of it as this third thing in between, because he sets up the paper that way, and that's what makes it quite compelling, where it's set up as we have these opposing worldviews, paradoxically they are similar in the sense that they both treat people as atomized decision makers. Here's how we need to look at things. But I don't think it's much of a stretch to say that he himself would say that any given behavior is influenced by all these layers, like things are operating at all three layers at the same time in society or in domains of human action and economic action in this case.
So I guess the next question I have is, how do we actually use, or maybe a better question would be, how do we apply these principles to better understand what's going around us now? And I highlighted one example of, well, transparency, because of the availability of additional or far greater and far faster information, has allowed people to have, or at least believe that they have a view into the way that decisions are being made, and therefore be able to critique it in ways that they hadn't been able to before, such as, like I said before, the smoky room and the desire for outcomes that sound fair. Smoky rooms don't sound fair because they seem closed, cronyist, whatever, you know, however you want to paint it. So now we have this issue where transparency, on the one hand, would be promoted as something to avoid conflict or to make things more fair, when it may, you know, some may argue that it's doing the opposite. Is there other applications or something to comment on there?
Another application could be, so if we look at that over-socialized view of this culture and we are culture takers, in today's world, we do see culture getting fragmented. The virtual worlds have a lot to do with this. And so there might be something interesting about how algorithms are determining our, almost our pattern of social relations, and what are the immediate things I'm responding to. My views on topics and on political questions, etc., might be operating, sure, at that individual layer of atomized decision making. But now there's this middle layer that's happening not just because of who I know or because of a country club or a smoke-filled room, but it's happening because of the algorithms on my news feeds or my social media feeds serving me different kinds of content and opinion.
Sort of like the strength of weak ties revisited, as in it's really, really difficult or more difficult, or maybe that's the question. Is it more difficult to be able to build weak ties in this sort of an environment?
And when we have these parasocial relationships with influencers or celebrities, what does that mean for this? You know, the point of embeddedness is that my economic action is embedded in social relations. So, you know, maybe brand A is advertising a lot and has descriptively great features, but I buy a car of brand B because that's who my kind of the social relations around me are driving. That's the brand they're using. What happens when now there's these parasocial relationships determined by algorithms? How does my economic behavior change, and maybe there's multiple layers within this embeddedness approach itself?
You asked about more modern applications as well. So if we work backwards from the discussion of the paper, there are some examples that we in the latter quarter that we haven't taken up today because they are properly of their time. But then there are others about the business opportunities, let's say, because there is that third leg of the triangle on markets and hierarchy. So there's an example here about the CEO acquiring firms, personally aggrandizing, and whether that setting essentially facilitated that more or not. And it's a tiny point, but it says, what the viewpoint proposed here requires is that future research on the market's hierarchies question pay careful and systematic attention to the actual patterns of personal relations by which economic transactions are carried out. So that would be a plus in the column for strength of weak ties considered or re-emphasized here, because it's saying you can have your economic patterns, you can have your macro social patterns. Don't forget to also account for your more meso and micro social patterns here. And I think that's the one thing that it gets taken up with, because in the actual discussion, it says that the explaining or justifying the concentration on neoclassical economics, they have implicitly accepted the presumption of economists that quote-unquote market processes are not suitable objects of sociological study because social relations play only a frictional and disruptive role, not a central one, in modern society. Ahem. Recent exceptions, Baker, Burton, White. I think that helps really nicely think about the balance that we said in the beginning part of the discussion on trust versus malfeasance. And here it's about ignoring things that have previously only been considered as frictional and disruptive, and therefore ignoring the positive facilitative aspects of it.
Another enduring, perhaps, legacy of not just this paper, but papers like this from a scholarly perspective, if one is trying to make theoretical claims or contributions or say something new, is this the structure of the argument where you've got essentially this micro macro and you're arguing for the meso, which we see repeated in other domains. So for example, in organizational learning, or just, you know, you might have the micro of individuals seeking information, learning, getting rewarded for it, etc. You had the March 91 kind of exploration exploitation where he introduces this organizational code. And so now this is akin to that over-socialized one where there's this one code and you are learning, the individual is learning vis-a-vis the organizational code. And then now more recent papers that simulate things like learning also bring in learning, interpersonal learning in one's immediate network vicinity, which these are similar structural moves we see in other topics, in this case, organizational learning, that bring in this meso level of looking at immediate patterns of social relations.
Those are all great points. I know that in my line of work right now, we're still emphasizing a lot of strategic, which is to read macro thought. But we also have been concentrating so much more on team building and what it takes to build teams, to build effective teams, whether that's a senior leadership team or whether that's a cross-cutting peer network team to be able to get things done, because of the implicit assumption that, you know, if you're operating in a very, very large, thick bureaucracy, that there are so many things that in order to get things done, you've got to, I don't want to say work around the bureaucracy, but you've got to come up with creative ways of greasing the skids, whatever that may mean. And it's almost kind of like the way we're promoting people getting things done, precisely because when you're in a large organization with a very, very heavy bureaucracy, you just assume that things move slow. There's a lot of barriers to overcome.
Yeah, this only just occurred to me, but there's definitely a parallel there with the concept of skunk works in innovation, where you've got kind of a team within the organization that doesn't, you know, is intentionally not socialized at the org level, but it's also not a lone inventor kind of working on something and reporting to his or her superiors. It's a team that's given this, they interact with each other. That is the pattern of social relations, and that's part of what makes it special. They have their own kind of sub-identity, and they are given the task of pursuing ambitious projects and stretch goals and short timelines, etc.
Yeah, and also they may be resented a little bit by the rest of the organization. Returns on investment become an interesting question, because for those types of organizations, you know, the skunkworks, they can produce some really wildly great things, or they may wind up not actually producing anything and yet still be successful in what they do, but the perception of how successful they are is somewhat viewed from a different lens, I suppose. Yeah, we're coming close to time. So if maybe we just sort of like think about what we want to say as a takeaway.
Sure, yeah. So in my case, I found it quite rewarding to revisit this paper. I had last read it during my PhD program, but rewarding at a almost a brass tacks level of I went back to the notes I had taken and noticed I had just put question marks on some things because I just didn't understand it at the time. And now I had a better way to read through the structure of the argument and understand what Granovetter is trying to do. I do agree with what Sarah said in part one, where the examples that he uses are not always the most compelling or clear-cut, especially if you think about the Coleman social capital paper that had a lot of rich examples that almost intuitively give you the argument as well. That was lacking a bit, but the actual theoretical argument was worth revisiting, because I think one takeaway was at the concrete level, this idea of looking at patterns of social relations, and of course, not new at all to social network scholars, but still important. But at another level, at an abstract level, was this takeaway of just how he has set up these camps and how he has argued for a theoretical concept and approach that threads the needle, and how we can see that kind of pattern replicate in different topics, different kind of scholarly papers.
I think one piece that we didn't discuss as much in our conversation today, but is really important for me, is thinking about the applications to current organizational forms and environments. So we've had a discussion before about platforms there's a section in the paper that talks about the extensive use of subcontracting and trying to think about how, what is good information, what is reputation, and other social evaluations, and how do they work in a setup where that's the norm, right? Where they're not just intermediaries, but where the distance between the two parties is purposefully large. And I think that's part of another way of thinking about hierarchies, right? Is that the distance between people among hierarchies is also purposefully large, but for different purposes. And I like this bit on the end of 498. He self-cites. So he says, information about employees travels among firms not only because personal relations exist between those in each firm who do business with each other, but also, as I have shown in detail, Granovetter 1974, because the relatively high levels of inter-firm mobility in the United States guarantee that many workers will be reasonably well known to employees of numerous other firms that might require and solicit their services. And I think that can simultaneously still be true and have limits in the current employment and organization environment that we are in and that we all choose to study most of the time as well. So I think we should look for opportunities to maybe push at that open door with our further discussions in this series.
I think that that's an active conversation going on about social media platforms associated with job searches and employment, the platform of which I will not name. It's kind of like, every single time we have a new technology, there's a response to it. thank you all for a great conversation. I'd like to just conclude on a note for our listeners that this is part of a series that we've done recently on economic sociology. We've had the episode with Fourcade on the value of nature in legal actions. And also we had not too long ago, the episode on Flickstein, Markets as Politics. So I encourage you to check that out. And also encourage you to check out the page that we put in our resource center on economic sociology, of which this episode is going to be mentioned. We'll add the mention to this, as we will after each new episode. We will include a new resource page based on the episode to sort of like keep the conversation going. So please share that with your colleagues and friends and students.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.